Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello, welcome again. Welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today in heroic fashion, driving over the mountains from Great Barrington for Medical Monday, is Dr. Deborah Bussino. She's board-certified pediatrician with McEnany Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine in Great Barrington. She specializes in the emotional development of children and adolescents, post-concussion care, adolescent gynecology, international travel medicine, and healthcare technology. Dr. Bussino earned her medical degree from Harvard Medical School. She completed a residency in pediatrics at Boston Children's Hospital. She's a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and also serves as school physician at Berkshire School and at Bard College at Simon's Rock. Dr. Bussino, sounds like you're busy. Welcome to Medical Monday.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Alan.
Well, I really do thank you. It was not an easy drive to come over here, and I know you scheduled it thinking that the snow would be over, but they fooled you, too.
Yep.
They got you. Okay. So the number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So, first question, of course, is I noticed that you are a post-concussion care specialist. I myself have been saying on these airwaves that it's really time to ban football altogether. You know, it's not been a popular position, but it's a correct position. What are you finding? Are people really screwing up their lives by butting heads?
Well, I think that's definitely a possibility. There's a potential there. I think the good thing that's happened over the last 5 years is that people have really become much more aware of what a concussion is, the consequences of it, and people really are being more careful on the field. I think the trainers are and the coaches are more educated to make sure that kids get off the field if there's a potential of having been hit in the head, and assessing for whether there could be a concussion, having them sit out, and then going to a physician that's trained in how to deal with concussions, assess them, and optimize recovery and help guide the student and family back to sports in a safe way. It can be done safely, but I think things need to be paid attention to.
Let me ask you a direct question. Would you want your kid to play football?
Well, we were talking about this a little bit before the show. If it were my kid, my child, I would say no, because I would just as soon not have him get hit like that. I think it's also hard as a mother to see your kid getting hit so hard. And so I would tend to agree with you personally. I don't really see the advantage of football, but it is such a big part of everyone's life that I don't think I can really make judgments about that for other people, but I can educate them and hopefully keep them safe when they are playing as best as possible. There are times also that if kids are getting too many concussions, then we really talk to them about, is it worth the risk you're taking with your brain? Your brain is one of the biggest, largest resources you have, so we need to be careful about it. But it's ultimately the family's decision, I think.
Well,
with education.
Yeah, so I noticed you said post-concussion care. What do you do when somebody has a concussion?
That's a good question. The thinking on that has actually changed some. It used to be the concept of you stayed in a dark room for 2 or 3 days with absolutely
really?
No stimulation to have your brain rest so that it would recover. I mean, if we step back a second and think about what is a concussion is essentially a bruise of the brain. Either usually on a microscopic level, there's swelling that interferes with the synapses between the neurons, and then you can end up with various symptoms such as difficulty concentrating, headaches, not feeling well, sometimes depression. So we want to pay attention to those things. And the way to get back to your question about how do you recover or treat a concussion, the concept is generally rest, maybe a day of fairly complete rest. And then we help, depending on the symptoms, we help the student, the child, gradually go back to their activities, prioritizing academics and making sure they're okay getting back to that, they can function well at school before there's any chance we let them back into the sports arena where they could get another head injury, because we need to be very careful about two head injuries close together. If that happens, you can end up with longer lasting, more severe symptoms.
Does Simon's Rock have a football team?
Simon's Rock does not have a football team. They have some teams, swim team. Yeah. I think they have a soccer team, the Llamas, but they don't have a football team.
But when the you get a concussion, what exactly does that mean? Does the skull crack, or is it no?
No, right. So the concussion is more about what's happening to the brain. Sometimes it can be, if the head trauma is significant enough, you can have both a skull fracture and a concussion. But most of the time, it's all happening internally, and you might not see anything on the outside of the head, which in fact is what makes it hard for people sometimes, because when you're concussed, you're having real biologic, physical symptoms. But from the outside, you look fine. And so that's why it's been a big challenge sometimes to educate the schools about the effects of concussion so that they understand that a student may not be up to par for, if you're lucky, a week or so. Sometimes it can be a month, 2 months, even 3 months before someone recovers from a concussion.
1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. In fact, if you call right now, your chances are guaranteed. 1-800-348-2551. So the Zika virus, so it's coming this way. I read it in the Times this morning. We're being told to get ready for it. You're the pediatrician in town. What do you think?
Well, I do think we've started talking to people. I think right now prevention is very important, just educating people about this virus. People have definitely changed travel plans if they're pregnant or there's any chance they will be coming pregnant so that they stay away from the areas that have the Zika virus, because we don't know everything there is to know about that virus, but it definitely has significant consequences that we need to be paying attention to.
Are you worried?
Am I worried?
Yeah.
Well, I think that if I were of childbearing age, I would be more concerned. I think that's where the primary concern is now for the developing fetus. But again, we don't know everything. And the other point about when we think about mosquitoes and traveling is that there are many diseases that people can get from mosquitoes when they travel. And I had a family come back recently, and it just made me realize, because we can get somewhere very easily these days, indeed, we tend to assume it's safe. And I think we just have to realize there's really things you need to pay attention to when you're traveling.
Right. 1-800-348-2551. A couple of people on the phone. That's great. As soon as we have some more to tell you about them, we'll let you know. 1-800-348-2551. Our wonderful Joe Mackowitz is here, and we'll be taking a call from Tara in Tilson. Of course it's Tara in Tilson. So there we go. Tara, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have a 5-year-old daughter. And she has some significant speech delays. And I have her, she doesn't have a practice yet. I have her in a SUNY New Paltz program. And I have her in the regular school district sends a speech therapist over to help. And we've been doing this at 5 years of age. She's at about an 18-month speech level. So she's about to start kindergarten. And I was wondering if you had any advice for me on how to build up her self-esteem and how to keep her positive with a whole new world of other kids and a little bit of slight bullying going on.
Thank you for your call, Tara. That's a good question, and I'm sure challenging as a parent. Different kids have different challenges. And I think sometimes finding the right services for your child with developmental delay can be very challenging. So it sounds like you've done a great job getting services for your child. And I think, you know, it's tough around the staying positive about yourself. I think the most important thing is that you're comfortable talking to your daughter about where she is, what challenges she's having. Let her open up and tell you about her frustrations, because that can go a long way. I think that the concept of we all have challenges and strengths, is an important one to keep in mind. I often, when kids come into my office, particularly about ADHD or various school problems, I'll ask them first off the bat, what do you feel good at? Because I think we have to remember to, you know, when they come to the doctor, it's all about problems that you have, and that can happen at school, too. Whereas,
and I don't want to put words in their mouth and say, is this how you feel? You know, I want her to be able to come to me and tell me, because I work in her preschool, and I've already seen a little bit, oh, you talk funny. Where do you come from? Why do you talk like that? Let's not play with her. She talks like that, but she's outgoing, and she doesn't let it get to her. But now, again, we're going to start kindergarten, and this whole learning differences and meeting new kids. It starts early with the, you know, obviously everybody's going to get a little picked on. And I just have concerns as a mother. So just basically just let her open up to me and just wait until she comes to me with issues.
Yeah, and I think you brought up
Would it be too much for me to go up to her and ask her about things? Or should I just wait for her?
Well, I think in general, if you're open to what she's saying, because I thought you brought up a great point, actually, you don't really know what's affecting a kid. I mean, we can imagine what might be bothering them, but it's really more about hearing where she's coming from and the things that are bothering her. So every once in a while, you can give her a teaser to ask her how things are going. But I would be careful, like you said, about putting thoughts in her mind, but being open to what she's telling you.
Tara, I wish we could spend some more time. We got to take a break.
Hey, you know what? I have some great help in the outside world, and I'm just glad I called in and got a little bit of advice from the doctor.
Well, we're delighted you called. Thank you, Tara.
Let's see how you do this here. Hang up. Okay, hang up. I did that. I think I hung up.
Okay, we're going to be right. Did I hang up, Jessac? I did. I think so. You can't tell. Okay, yeah, we did. Okay, so now we're going to take a short break. 7 to 7, 8 seconds. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for more information. Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, where the 20-acre campus becomes a living laboratory for learning in all grades, pre-K through 9th grade. A good beginning never ends, pinecobble.org. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. And from Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including assisted living and more. Caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800.
And we are back, and thank you so much, Zachary, for staying with me as I learn the new system here. Let's go to line number 2. And that should be Karen. Karen, is that you?
It's me. Thank you so much, because I just saw the movie Concussion yesterday.
Ah.
My question is, I ski, and I fall a lot on my head, and I have had quite a few concussions. And I pass out briefly, nothing major. And I'm just wondering, is that anything to be concerned about? I mean, I rest, and I do all in terms of long-term.
Right. Well, I think there are some things to think about. One thing we're realizing now is that the degree of the symptoms, the degree of the concussion is actually determined by the degree of symptoms and how long they last. So
okay.
I would advise you to really listen to your body. Do you have a headache that's persisting? Is your stomach upset? Are you having difficulty concentrating when you're trying to read a book? Is it harder to remember what you've just read? If those things are happening, I think you want to be very careful not to go back to your activity where you may hit your head again until you have fully recovered for at least 2 to 3 days, totally symptom-free.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're having, we also know that multiple concussions put you at more risk. So I would see a physician if you've had a few, especially if your symptoms are lasting longer each time, then you're taking more of a hit from a given fall. Mm-hmm. So there are physicians out there now dealing with concussions. Berkshire Health Systems actually has just opened up a concussion care clinic about a year ago. So they do that assessment there. We're doing the assessment, the same kind of assessment within our primary care, which I think is helpful to have within the context of primary care. But there's a lot of thinking going around concussions
and,
now.
And, you know, having seen the movie where it was unclear if anything can be done, if I went to the Berkshire Health Systems, right now I'm symptom-free, but it's been about a month and a half, what are they able to do to help a person?
Well, they can test. There are different ways of testing. There's something called the IMPACT program, which is a computerized program that gives you a sense of how it's an objective way to see if your brain is still concussed in any way. But if you are fully recovered, it's really a lot about education, understanding what has happened to your brain, what you need to avoid in the future, what you need to be careful about.
Right. As for me, I would ban skiing along with.
you need exercise, Alan.
Walking is good.
Yes, that's true.
Well, yeah. I just got a new helmet finally.
Very good.
Thank you both.
Okay,
I appreciate
bye.
It.
Hang up. Okay. So anyway, we got lots of free lines, ladies and gentlemen, and a great time to make a call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Mark in Albany. Okay, Mark, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Hey, after just hearing the skiing thing, I'm a little nervous because my question is about snowboarding.
Uh-huh. But at any rate, I'd ban that also.
Yeah. Well, someone near and dear to me had a concussion, a medium grade one at age 20, snowboarding, and then just recently, about a month ago, had another one at age 30. And the last caller, there were some good answers there that helped me, but then one last part of the question is, how much risk is there to this person at age 50 or 60 having these football player kind of really, really bad things if he were to have just, say, one every 10 years or something like that? How worried does he have to be to maybe not snowboard again or because of the multiple concussion long-term effect?
Right. Good question, Mark. I mean, I think it is dependent on the person's body. Different brains are affected differently by concussion, so it's important to think about how long the symptoms lasted after each concussion. If they only lasted a couple of days for each concussion, probably not a lot of risk going forward. But if the first one had a week of concussions, the second one had 2 to 3 weeks to even a month of symptoms after that, then I would be more cautious, and I would particularly be cautious in the next couple of years, because I think that's, you know, again, the closer they are, we're realizing that tends to have more impact.
All right, great. That's real helpful.
Thank you very much. All right. Now we'll go to Dan in Cornwall. Okay, Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello, doctor. Hello, Alan.
Hi.
My question is regarding baseline testing for children. I have I'm a lacrosse coach, and my 9-year-old son plays lacrosse and also plays soccer quite aggressively. And my wife and I have been discussing having some baseline testing done, but I'm not completely familiar. I have an idea of how it works, but I was wondering if you could comment on the value of that.
Sure. I think baseline testing is talked a lot about these days. The high school sports teams for most schools are doing baseline concussion testing as a part of the school athletic program. So we do offer baseline testing in our office. The tests are not very well validated below about 11 years old. Sometimes if you have a child who's mature intellectually, you can get a good reading. But 11, less than 11, it's hard to really have norms. And then the concept of baseline, theoretically, it's a very good concept, because then when you do this repeat, it has to do with this IMPACT, the neurocognitive computer program that I discussed, that we use as one of the objective ways to assess the degree of concussion. We put a lot of things together when assessing the concussion. We put symptoms together. We put, do you have increased symptoms after you use your brain for 20 minutes doing this program? So anyway, theoretically, to know what your baseline is, to then be able to compare to what it looked like after you had an injury, would be helpful. The problem is we have to tell the kids how to do the baseline, to really take it seriously, because what we're finding is a lot of kids, when they do it at school, they sit down in one classroom with everyone else and they don't take it very seriously. They just kind of go through the test. And then we're finding that the baseline test results aren't that helpful. Like, basically after the injury, their scores are considerably better than their baseline. And we know that their baseline's probably better the way it looks. So I think a baseline can be very helpful, but you have to make sure it's done in the right way so that it's an accurate test.
Okay, very good. Can I ask one other question?
Go ahead.
There's a lot of new technology in mouth guards lately. Is there any correlation? I mean, I know there is a correlation between concussions and mouth guards and the use of mouth guards. Can you talk about that real briefly?
I'm actually not sure about the direct correlation with that. I think the mouth guards are primarily there to protect the mouth. I mean, certainly the helmets, we need to pay attention to the kind of helmet we're using. You can have problems with the jaw. I don't know that the mouth guards do a lot to protect against the head, the brain in particular.
Okay.
I've got to let you go. Thank you very much for calling. Great questions. All right, we'll go to Nancy. All right, Nancy is about to be on the air. Okay, Nancy, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Nancy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I have a 2-year-old granddaughter, and I think they were just doing some regular blood testing. They found some lead in her blood, they made some dietary recommendations, but I'm not... And subsequently, there's been another test, and they found that her levels are coming down. But I wanted to hear what the doctor thought about what's a normal level, what's a safe or an unsafe level, and if she had any recommendations beyond the iron-containing foods and the bottled water that was already recommended.
Nancy, thanks for your call. That's an important pediatric issue with the lead. Currently, the number the CDC feels is high lead is 5 or above. So we're all exposed to some lead in our environment. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is if it's a finger stick screen, you may actually be picking up lead. The initial test may have been lead from the skin, which doesn't really affect our brain. It has to be in the bloodstream. As far as things that can be helpful, it's definitely true to make sure the child is not anemic. That means low iron. That's why they suggested the increased iron foods. Because if you're anemic, if you don't have enough iron in your blood, your body tends to absorb more lead. So that's the connection there. If the child had a higher lead level, one would actually have them take iron to make sure that that's helping that situation out with the anemia. The most important thing is to think about where the source is coming from and make sure that that's been taken care of so that the child's not continually exposed.
Now, what was this term, chelate? What does that mean?
So chelate, when you have a very high lead level,
yeah,
more in the 50s, that's using certain chemicals to leach the lead out of the blood.
Yeah.
So that's a treatment for lead poisoning. Fortunately, with the awareness these days, we don't have many kids getting to those levels that need to be chelated,
right,
but that certainly was more prevalent in the past.
So I have a sort of a follow-up, because you said something about the source of the lead. And they did live in a fairly older home, and they thought possibly the paint.
Sure.
But, I mean, there wasn't paint chipping or cracking, or there was no renovation going on. And later on, apparently, the community, the municipality in which they live, was tested, and that was found to have, in the municipal water supply, some lead. Do you have any comments on
just
either
two
of
quick
those
comments,
and how likely?
Two quick comments. Lead pipes are an issue, particularly if you're drawing all your water first thing in the morning. You don't want to draw all your water first thing in the morning and then put a jug of it in the refrigerator to stay cold, because that water is going to have sat in the pipes overnight.
Interesting.
So that's one thing to be careful of. The other thing I just always tell my parents in my practice is that the most important thing you can do in an old house is to replace the windows, because if you have painted sills around the windows and you're moving them up and down all the time, that's aerosolizing the old paint that's underneath the fresh layer. So there's a lot of issues. There's a lot of websites. I know Massachusetts has a good website on educating people about lead, but those are two main points.
Yeah, those are very helpful. Nancy, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, doctor. Have a good day.
All right. Now we'll go to Ellen in Shelburne Falls. Okay. Ellen, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hi. I have a grandson who was diagnosed at birth with hypothyroid, and he's been on this synthetic thyroid medication daily. So my two questions are, his parents are thinking of moving on from synthetic to a natural medication, is one question. And then when do they retest and reassess the situation?
Thank you for your call, Ellen. Those are interesting points. I think one thing with the switching from synthetic to natural forms of the thyroid hormone, you have to be very careful about that because the natural medications, the herbal medications that we use these days are not regulated by the FDA. So the amount, the actual effective medication in the product you're getting can be very varied, whereas the one thing we know about the synthetic thyroid hormones are we know exactly how much we're giving. So that
What if we know they're going to a doctor who is, you know, educated and follows proper guidelines?
Well, if you can really attest to how much thyroid hormone is in that natural product, then you're probably okay. But I don't know that the manufacturers of these products are that precise these days. And I would be very hesitant in a small child because I think small amounts in a small body are going to make more difference.
Right.
Does this put you in a bad...
retesting at a certain point and that maybe he has somehow gotten to a point where he doesn't need the med? Is that possible?
It's possible, but I'd have to know what's causing the hypothyroidism. Oftentimes, it's because the body's making antibodies against the thyroid gland, and that process could burn itself out, or it may not. But there's actually several different kinds of processes that may lead to the hypothyroid state. So you'd have to understand that to know. But certainly retesting, having information makes a lot of sense.
Ellen, I got to let you go. A lot of people behind you. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah, bye. Let's see here. I'm looking at the time. All right. Let's go to Chris in Boston. Okay, Chris, you are on. Go ahead, Chris.
Hello?
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 Can you hear us?
Hi, yes, I can.
Oh, good.
Hi, I'm so glad to be able to talk to the doctor. I have a grandson who is obese at this point. I consider him to be obese. On his other side of the family, obesity is there, especially with some children who are about 300 pounds. My grandson never seemed to have a satiation point. As a younger child at 4, he would eat an adult portion at a restaurant and a child's portion. I just don't know if maybe there's a test, blood test, something genetically that could be found to help him.
Chris, you bring up some good points. How old is your grandson now?
He's 7 years old.
Okay, so...
And my fear, too, is he's very, very active. But my fear is if that changes, you know, it could be really detrimental.
Right. So obesity, as you know, is something that our society is struggling a lot with. Pediatricians certainly struggle with it. As far as tests to know if there's something genetic, I mean, there is something we call metabolic syndrome, which tends to run in families, which the side of the family that you were mentioning being obese, that basically has to do with insulin resistance, that your insulin doesn't work as well. So it doesn't break down your food as well. And that can be a vicious cycle because once you have increased fat cells in the body, you get more insulin resistance. So there is a way to test for that, for metabolic syndrome in particular, but it still comes down to portion control, healthy eating, exercise. It's great the exercise is in there. And if people have this metabolic syndrome, then they just have to they work harder with the dietary means. And there are other things that are coming into play. There are some medicines for older children. The bariatric surgery, if children are really having a trouble when they're in their teens, can be considered. But these are definitely important things to pay attention to. So thank you for your call.
So at 7 years old, he could get a metabolic syndrome test?
You can see if there's tendencies toward that, but sometimes you see it at seven, but not sometimes it does develop later on. So just because you test now and it's okay does not mean you're in the clear.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now we'll take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Nathan Littower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, community hospital for over 100 years, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Littower, working to help put patients at ease with colonoscopies, NLH.org. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering an entirely online MS in nutrition and the RN to BS in nursing program. Open house April 21st, Poughkeepsie, adelphi.edu. The Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, a team of four uro-oncologists with 75 years of combined experience, providing advanced robotic surgery for kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer. Urologyoncology.com. And from Union College Concert Series, presenting the Artemis String Quartet, making appearances in Carnegie Hall. The German quartet performs works by Bartok and Beethoven, Sunday, April 10th at 3 p.m. UnionCollegeConcerts.org.
And we are back with Deborah Bucino, board-certified pediatrician with Maconi, pediatric and adolescent medicine in Great Barrington, but I got the name wrong, didn't I? It's Maconi.
It's close enough. Yeah, Maconi, yeah.
Yeah, Maconi. Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, this is the last round from here to the end. There are two people on the phone, but we have free lines, and I'd like everybody who wants to ask a question but hasn't done it to get online. We go quickly around here. We'll go to Chris in Bethlehem. Okay, Chris, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. We're traveling to Ecuador at the end of the month, and I have two children, 12 and 14. What kind of shots or vaccinations would you recommend?
So, Chris, I appreciate your question. I can't give exactly specific information over the air to your case, but I can talk in general about travel and travel to Ecuador. First of all, the CDC, cdc.gov, has a great website, and they have a travel section there. And you can put what country you're going to, and they will tell you exactly what shots you need, and then also whether you need to think about malaria and yellow fever in particular. The hepatitis A vaccine is one that most people get when they travel. That one is now actually part of routine pediatric immunizations, so your children may already have that. And then one thinks about the typhoid vaccine as well. It also depends on what you're going to be doing when you travel. If you're going to be staying with local families, then that's a bit more risk, particularly because a lot of the things that you, diseases you can get, basically come from contaminated water because they don't clean their water as well, and also mosquito bites. So the more exposure you're going to have to those things, then you're at more risk. Then it also, on the CDC site, they have the actual specific areas where you have to worry about malaria and where you have to worry about yellow fever. So you can look on those maps, and if you're going there, then you need to check in with your doctor, and they can prescribe malaria medicine or refer you to a travel clinic for the yellow fever vaccine.
And do you always have to go to a travel clinic, or would most pediatricians give the yellow fever shot?
The yellow fever vaccine in particular has to be given at a travel clinic because it actually is associated with a bit more side effects, and they have to control that in a more specific situation. But everything else that you get when you travel can be taken care of by a regular physician, as long as they are knowledgeable about travel medicine, which a lot of people are traveling now, so more physicians have become knowledgeable about that. The only other vaccine that is hard to get from a regular doctor is the Japanese encephalitis vaccine. That's often more an issue when you're traveling to Asia.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Great question. Do we have a travel clinic in the Berkshires?
There is one in Pittsfield.
Pittsfield. Yep. With the hospital? Or
I think it's associated with Berkshire Health Systems.
Interesting. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have lots of free lines right now, and this is a great time to make a call. We'll go to Keith in Athens. Okay, Keith, you're on. 1-800-3- let me just give that number, Keith. 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, Keith.
I've had three concussions at ages, two concussions, actually, three head injuries. The first concussion was at age 6, the second at 18, and I had a kick in the head by a mule when I was 12. I did play football in high school and college and never had a serious injury. The only serious injuries I've had were these head injuries. And for about at least 10 years, it could be even 20, I haven't really kept track, I wake up with severe headaches and nausea, and I would just say as a sideline, I am a very moderate drinker, like maybe 3 glasses of wine a week. But in my 60 plus years, I have had probably as many hangovers as on fingers of one hand. So I do know what a hangover feels like, and this feels exactly like a hangover, but it doesn't seem to be connected at all to whether or not I've had alcohol the night before. And the only solution, no painkiller works, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, nothing works, aspirin. The only way to get rid of it is to sleep it off, and it usually takes at least a day in bed just to get rid of the headache, and I'm totally without function until it's gone.
Yeah, so Keith, headaches I know can be quite troublesome, and I assume you've spoken to a physician about this because headaches are also very complex, and there's a lot of different things that can cause them. But I would like to address, I think one question you bring up is these head injuries when you were young and the potential concussions, do they have any impact? Are they part of what's causing your headaches now, which I think is what you're asking? And I think we can say if they happened well over 20 years ago and you really didn't have any symptoms for those 20 years that could have been associated with those headaches, it's pretty unlikely that the things that happened back then to your brain are affecting where it is now. If you had had headaches, problems with headaches going through that, then there might be some, you know, reason to think that they're connected. That's what I would tend to say about that piece of it.
I did have frequent headaches up until, and again, I'm not sure how long ago, about 15 to 20 years ago, I realized I was caffeine dependent. And if I didn't have caffeine coffee, I would get a real bad headache. So I weaned myself off of caffeine, and I don't go near caffeine anymore. And but I don't know if that has anything to do with the headaches. It seemed the ones that I used to get were due to caffeine dependence. So that's not a factor anymore, but I still get the headaches, and it feels just like a hangover.
Right. Well, again, headaches are so complex, and I think checking in with a doctor at this point who really specializes in headaches makes sense for you because they can be debilitating, I know.
Do children have headaches?
Definitely. Yes. Children can have headaches. Children get migraines, particularly if it's in the family. There's a lot of different kinds of headaches, muscle tension headaches. Right. We see a fair amount of that in kids. Fortunately, a lot of headaches in kids are not that concerning, and usually the over-the-counter medicine will take care of things. We do have to watch for the red flag type headaches, which actually involve waking up in the morning with a headache and GI symptoms. I mean, if that is happening new, if that's a new symptom, we would be concerned about potentially brain tumor or something like that. So,
true.
But if it's been going on a while and not progressing, it's less likely that.
Keith, thanks for the call.
I find a doctor that specializes in headaches.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Right? To find a doctor who specializes in headaches.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Keith, how do I do that?
Oh.
What area are you in? Are you in the Albany area or...
I'm not far from Albany. Athens. I'm in Greene County.
Yeah.
I think that the neurology department at Albany Medical Center probably has someone.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Right. 1-800-348-2551. I'll read, while waiting for Joe, I will read to you Hello, I have a 12-year-old son who has high cholesterol. Is that a concern? There's a family history of cardiac disease in my family.
I like that question, particularly in light of the question we had on obesity as well, because we are realizing that things that are starting early in childhood really do impact heart disease later on.
Sure.
So cholesterol actually is an issue for young children. It really depends on how high it is. But we are now screening routinely at checkups between age 9 and 11 and looking particularly for elevated LDL, which is the bad cholesterol.
Lousy.
If the, pardon me?
L for lousy.
Yes, the lousy cholesterol. So if that is up in the range of 160, then that is actually close to needing medication. And people are using medication for cholesterol in children starting around age 10. And there's specialists that deal with that. And if it's lower, then it's about diet and things like that. But it's definitely important to recognize and pay attention to, especially if there's a family history.
Okay. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. All right. Let's go to Mary in Rome. All right, Mary, you're in Rome. Go ahead.
Hello. In 1994, I had an MRI, and it ended up showing a rather significant rare condition called an Arnold-Chiari malformation. And I think the doctor will recognize that name, but most people don't.
Right, I do recognize it, yes.
Good. And I'm not sure how it could have happened. I'm kind of guessing it might have come been congenital. I was my mother's first child and her largest baby, and I wondered if you've run into those and if it's possible that can happen in at birth.
An interesting point. The Arnold-Chiari actually is, I think, not that rare now because of our technology to pick things up. The MRIs that are often being done for headaches and various things like that are actually picking up Arnold-Chiari malformations in many people. What that is basically that the brainstem is just pulled down a little bit into the spinal column so that if it's graded, I think it's 1 to 4. And the higher grade you have, the more the brainstem is pulled down. And that can cause symptoms of headaches, particularly in the back of the head. But if it's grade 1, just very mild, then it's probably an incidental finding where it really isn't going to have a lot of impact, doesn't tend to get worse. I think you're right in calling it congenital, but I think you may very well have been born with it. It's not necessarily something that's caused by something, but just the way the body is created. And now that we have better imaging, we're beginning to see all these things that we didn't know existed before.
Okay, thank you for that. I also want the public to be aware of it. And I understand if some doctors, you know, feel it's just an insignificant finding, but mine is very apparent on an MRI to a, you know, a novice or an amateur. And I think it's around 9 millimeters, and it's supposed to be atypical. It's really down out of the skull. And now I'm not, I'm almost 70 now. And if it is a big problem, the treatment is not that always that successful. So I'm just going to try to live with it. But I would like to explain that in my case, which I think is related, is if I tip my head upward to look at the sky, oh, the pressure builds up. I get this. Sure,
yeah, you're probably right. Good luck with that, because I think you're right. It can be problematic, but hopefully it'll be okay for you since you've been with it for a long time.
Hey, Mary, we're trying to get everybody behind you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Okay, we'll go to Bernie in Oneonta. Okay, Bernie in Oneonta, you're on. You're on, Bernie.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
My question has to do with the location of the point of impact on the head.
For a concussion.
Yes, right. Okay. Related to the concussion. As someone who suffered concussions at the age of 6 and the age of 60, I'm curious whether or not there's an increased vulnerability at that location in the brain. And I'm also curious to know whether, in the research that's been done on concussion and brain injuries, whether these locations have been recorded for the individuals and then looked at in the aggregate, and whether there's been any conclusions drawn from this.
Right. You bring up a really good point about location in the brain, and sometimes it is very specific, and the only way we can know right now is the symptoms that people are having. So I had one patient who the only thing that was affected was his balance. He was just way off balance for a couple of days. And so that was telling me that a certain part of the brain was affected. And if you have something that localized and then it occurs again, then you are affecting the same part of the brain. Although I don't really think, I mean, there are functional imaging studies that people are beginning to look at now to try to localize things. The best we can do right now for the most part is pay attention to what the symptoms are and whether that's a specific part of the brain.
Has the location of an individual's injury been recorded and then looked at in the aggregate, or is this
Not in any large numbers. Not in any large numbers.
Do you think it's something that might be worth looking at?
Yeah, I think that's a good thing people could look into.
Good study. Thank you, Bernie. Okay, we'll go to Mary in New Paltz. Okay, Mary in New Paltz, you're on the air. Go, Mary.
Hi, doctor. I'm calling about my granddaughter, who was 1.5 and been diagnosed with febrile seizures, which occur obviously because of a seizure. But in trying to research this for my own peace of mind, I was wondering, what is the neurophysiological or neurochemical agent that might actually trigger this seizure?
Okay, very quickly then, doctor, would you tell us what it is?
Right, so a febrile seizure is children under 5, when they have a fever, particularly when the fever's going straight up, can get a seizure, a convulsive seizure. To answer the question, I think the way to understand it is the fever brings down what we call the seizure threshold. So someone who's a little prone to maybe have a seizure in the first place, the fever brings it down, it makes it more likely to have the seizure happen. Mm. We know that that tends to be something that's genetic, and actually, unless there's a strong family history of other kinds of seizures, the children usually grow out of that by age 5.
Interesting.
Okay.
Thank
All
you,
right.
Mary.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And we'll go to Nick in Altamont. Okay, Nick, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I was listening about a couple of gentlemen who had a head problem, falling down, repeated concussions. If they keep doing it again and again, why don't they do something to prevent it from happening in the future, like learn how to develop your balance? Something that would help them would be taking a course with a yoga. Or if they want to get more advanced, once they like the yoga, they can go into Tai Chi.
Yeah, that's
I've done it, and I love it.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and I agree with you about the balance. Balance helps prevent concussions. In fact, we make sure that children's balance is back to their baseline before we send them back to sports, because if your balance is off, like you said, your reflexes aren't the same, you're more likely to get injured again. It's a very good point.
And the concussion that they had many years later, that could be a residual thing. I, when I was, I don't know, 6, 7 years old, I fell on my head in school, and I had a good bump. My parents took me to the doctor. They couldn't find anything wrong. But in that same area, I'm 75 now, I have a little bit of a gray spot of hair, which is due to a late injury.
Right. I want to just step in there and say it's very important for us to be paying attention to these brain injuries, but I don't think we have to worry about every little hit to the head. If you pay attention to what happened to your body, it's really about symptoms. It's interesting. Sometimes you can get an egg on the head just because a blood vessel under the scalp has broken.
Right. It's scar tissue.
Yeah, So anyway, I hear what you're saying. Thanks for calling in.
And on one last thing I would like to say, and you know, you're right if somebody doesn't have good balance. But if you're hanging around a mule, which one guy was, and the mule kicks you in the head, that's a little different than balance. Thank you very much.
Well, yes, he could. But if you're quick enough for learning how to move.
Get out of the way.
You can get out of the way before the mule picks his feet up.
Well, thank you very much. Okay.
Yep.
And let's see, we really don't have any more time. I'm so sorry. You've been a wonderful guest, Deborah Bucino.
And really have a heroin award coming to you from WAMC for getting over here today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. Thanks to our engineer, Zachary Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for doing a terrific job answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a little theme, maybe a comment by somebody at the station, and then the news.